From failure to power, from collaboration to money, from participation to equity,
we want to poke and provoke conversations about the key themes we need to address as urban resilience practitioners, researchers, and policymakers.
Welcome to Urban Resilience Dialogues. I am Chiara.
And I am Corina.
In this third episode of Urban Resilience Dialogues, we are talking about vulnerability. Vulnerability is a key concept in urban resilience and links the relationship that people have with their environment to the social forces, the institutions, and the cultural values that sustain but also contest them. It has also become a bit of a contested concept in its own right. Who is deemed vulnerable, who identifies as vulnerable, and when it is seen as a positive rather than a negative characterization. But today we also want to zoom out a bit and explore the meaning of vulnerability as a way of sitting with grief and suffering, as well as the vulnerability of our pale blue dot, as Carl Sagan named a photograph of our planet from outer space, like a lonely speck in the great enveloping cosmic dark.
And to explore this all with us, we're joined by Mudula Koshi. Mudula, you're an urbanist and doctoral researcher at the Norwegian University of Science and Technology. Your current work investigates the concepts of uncertainty, of resilience, contingency, and their strategic use. And this is at the intersection of spatial planning, of decision-making and governance, of disaster risk reduction and humanitarian responses, so that we can better deal with unprecedented environmental crises in developmental contexts. And before that, you also worked in urbanism offices in the Netherlands on long-term initiatives in energy landscapes, urban metabolism, post-fossil energy scenarios, and multi-scalar design solutions, circular economy, productive cities, sustainable mobility infrastructure. So quite a broad portfolio of expertise that you bring to this topic. And on a more personal level, you're also a fiction and storytelling enthusiast, and you explore the Norwegian mountain landscapes. Thank you for joining us today to share your experience and your story. And so, to kick off our dialogue, can you tell us a bit about yourself and how your work in architecture and urban planning and all these different disciplines relates to aspects of urban resilience?
Thank you, Chiara and Corina, for the great introduction. I'm really happy to be here. So I'm going to try and join the dots here a little bit. I am originally from Kerala. It is a coastal province in the southern part of India. However, I was raised in Qatar, and there I had about 15 years of very protected and sheltered life in the tabula rasa of the Middle East. And then as a teenager, I moved to India. And already you can imagine, right? As a teenager, you're grappling with all the complexities and teen angst. And then I moved to a country which was quite overwhelming in many aspects. So on the one hand, I was quite taken by the colorful and the energetic life and the throes of people. But on the other hand, you also have vast socio-spatial inequalities and the hierarchies and opportunities. All of this also formed a great imprint on me. So you had aspiring global cities like Delhi and Mumbai. You had a newly emerging middle class. And this simultaneously coexisted with urban fragments at the margins of expanding cities, where you had inhabitants from vulnerable communities and informal settlements. Later, after my high school, I gravitated towards architecture for my bachelor's. I worked as an architect for 2.5 years. But by then, I had this kind of, if you want to call it, an undercurrent of disillusionment. And I was really thinking to myself, like, is this idea of designing opulent homes and apartment complexes mainly for the elites and the aspiring middle class, is that what I'm supposed to be doing? It didn't really hold so much meaning to me. And I was very curious more about the larger scales. I really wanted to understand what actually lies behind the gated communities. What is beyond these high walls? And how can you actually try to integrate different issues of planning and design and social justice? And then in 2012, I moved to the Netherlands to pursue a postmaster's in Delft, mainly in urbanism. I worked in 4 years in various urbanism offices. And then I, like you said, I had experience in a wide portfolio of projects, right from energy landscapes to urban metabolism and mobility infrastructure. And in 2018, I moved to Norway to pursue my PhD. So currently, my work mainly deals with various facets of uncertainty in unprecedented environmental crises. And I try to focus on developmental context because these are contexts that have weak institutional mechanisms, the resources are scarce, and the vulnerabilities are quite chronic. And somehow, by way of coincidence, 2 weeks after I started my PhD, there was the floods in 2018 in Kerala. And this was the first of its kind, the last big floods that happened in 1924. And you can imagine that being so far away from home, it was very overwhelming and helpless to see it from so far. And then there was the idea that, well, I am going to research on uncertainty. Why don't I take this as my case? And of course, then there was the idea that, oh, it is a rare event. Maybe for the next 100 years, we're not going to see something like this. But in 2019, pretty much at the same time, it happened on the exact same high magnitude. And all of this combined, I guess you could say that then it brought me into this realm of resilience. And now I try really to understand what are the cultural and community dimensions of resilience and how can you actually operationalize it.
So what I understand from what you're explaining to us is that in your work and research, you've been exploring different aspects of vulnerability, from the different scales of vulnerability to the different ways in which it plays out and the root causes that lead to vulnerability. So could you tell us a bit more about the context of your work in Kerala and how it links to the concept of vulnerability?
So of course, Kerala, like I mentioned, is a province, which is a coastal province on the southern part of India. And my work is situated in Wayanad, and Wayanad is a hill district. And out of the 14 districts, Wayanad is considered the least developed because it has lesser services and infrastructural facilities. Mainly the population there depend on agriculture as their prime economic activity. And there is a cultivation of cash crops, such as banana, tea, and coffee. And in addition, because of the idyllic mountainous landscapes of Wayanad, it is also an expanding hospitality industry, which caters to regional tourists. So you have about 90% of the area, which is reserved for forest and plantations and agriculture, which means about 10% is left to urban development. But then there is this tension because there is very less land developed that is available for urban development. And this stresses the mountain areas because variously unsustainable ways of building construction, whatever existing wetlands and paddy fields that you have, we have tried to convert it into real estate. And because of a monoculture of cash crops, this also reduces the fertility of the soil. So overall, this increases the fragility of the place. Wayanad is also home to marginalized tribal communities. They comprise about 18% of the population. And because of historic marginalization, they have lesser access to education, lesser access to decentralized governance mechanisms that Kerala is most known for. This also limits their social mobility. And among them, those communities who are landless are mainly daily wage laborers in plantations. These are mostly owned by settlers from other districts and other states. And previously, Wayanad has also suffered from acute droughts. And this is something that is quite common to other parts of India as well, where several small-scale farmers are most vulnerable to these acute droughts. This either pushes them to suicides or they migrate to neighboring provinces for work. And I think all of these multiplicity in the complexities. And all of this was actually quite evident in how vulnerabilities in Wayanad are chronic. And the floods in 2018 and 2019 in some ways have maybe only exacerbated it. And while Wayanad dealt quite commendably with the short-term uncertainties related to the floods, because the emergency flood response had a combination of both decentralized governance mechanisms and community resourcefulness, systemic and long-term challenges still remain quite unsolved.
Vulnerability also seems to be a close siblings of resilience, and we see many times they are used together, especially in the context of urban challenges. So what are some of the contradictions or tensions that you see playing out when we use this term?
Yeah, you're actually quite right. They are often mentioned in tandem with each other, especially in social sciences and hazard literature. And vulnerability is commonly, you could say, defined in terms of opposites. So on the one hand, if you look at it through the lens of a socioeconomic perspective, then perhaps entitlement and security are key elements. But if you look at it through an ecological perspective, then robustness and resilience are core tenets. And vulnerability is mainly expressed in terms of resilience when you refer to the ability of socio-ecological systems and when they have to reconfigure themselves when subject to change. And so you could say that this was perhaps the inroad into understanding how vulnerability to environmental change is actually considered as a characteristic of socio-ecological systems linked to resilience. And I guess particularly it's quite relevant, this perspective, in the context of climate change. You have both physical and social factors that typically would influence a group's or individual's susceptibility to climate extremes. And when you consider physical factors, this could be because of perhaps exposure to risk, such as floods, storm surges, hurricanes, and cyclones. And on the other hand, you have social factors, and this is mainly related to socioeconomic, institutional, political arrangements, which could either limit the capacity of a community or it could enhance their capacity to either cope with or adapt to climate hazard or external stress placed on their livelihood and well-being. So in that sense, you could state that various facets of vulnerability are actually linked to the state of powerlessness and inequality. And just to come back to your question a little bit, I think one of the main tensions that I at least observe when looking at it through this perspective is that when vulnerability is not accounted for in decision-making and adaptive action, it only tends to reduce the vulnerability of those who have access to governance institutions or who are best placed to take advantage of this mechanism. So it doesn't really help in reducing the vulnerability of the marginalized. And to give you an example, I could actually go back to Wynard itself. So in Wynard, the systemic vulnerability is mostly because it is felt by the marginalized tribal communities. And to familiarize with you a context a little bit, so tribal communities in Wynard used to be indigenous populations. And then during the colonial times, during the British rule, Wynard used to be seen as an attractive hill station. It had these idyllic mountains and cool climate. So it was considered perfect for tea plantations. So then they set up tea plantations and estates there. And then later, even post-independence, the same pattern of settling from outside Wynard continued. So in a way that the land that used to be part of tribal communities, ancestral land, this was then kind of not theirs anymore because governments also incentivized settlers from other districts to go and settle in Wynard. And because of that, the tribal communities were rendered landless as a result. And what happens is that some of them, including other marginalized communities, now they're occupying lands that is actually fragile and flood prone, thereby increasing their susceptibility to vulnerability. And to kind of stage a little bit of a reaction against it, in 2003, the tribal communities had also made a call for rights to their ancestral lands. So they staged a protest. And for a while, it occupied societal consciousness. Mainly as a subaltern movement. But this again happened only for a very brief period of time. And their demands were not really met. The amount of land that they were then given by the government was significantly lesser. And I think this is where you kind of see this kind of tensions, because how can you actually talk about vulnerability and resilience when it's about very chronically placed marginalized communities?
I think that's such a powerful example. And I think this almost plays quite well into the next sort of question that we had for you, which is almost kind of like, how do we see the different narratives that are at play about vulnerability? And in a way, how do we avoid romanticizing this? Because I think we're in a real danger of almost seeing vulnerability as something that is this romantic ideal of a condition that can be managed externally and can be handled. But these issues obviously affect lives, and we can try to increase resilience, so we can try to proactively, you know, support individual, community or urban resilience while needing to address the root causes of vulnerability. But I'm really curious, how do we avoid vulnerability from becoming just a label that disempowers people, you know, a label that is placed on communities and on groups? And I'm wondering, do the people in communities you've encountered in your work, do they identify themselves as vulnerable groups?
Those are very interesting questions, actually. So I'm going to start here with a bit of a narrative. So that's mainly related to food security and entitlements. Like we actually saw, one way of looking at vulnerability is the entitlements approach. So Amartya Sen, in a seminal work in the mid-1970s and 1980s, he put forward this whole idea of entitlements approach. So what he did was he analyzed some of the famines that had occurred in the past. Most notably was the famine called the Bengal famine in 1943. So Bengal is a province in the east of India. And this was 1943. So this was when India was still occupied by British rule. And about 2.1 to 3 million people were considered to have lost their lives during a span of about a couple of years. And before he actually put forward his analysis, there was the general idea that famines are caused by a lack of food availability. But he clearly showed that famine, especially this one, was not really the result of a lack of food availability, but actually was a result of the deprivation of food and lack of democracy during colonial times. And this narrative is much more accepted these days, and people understand that famines and food security are much more often caused by disease, war, or civil strife, and they're not just triggered by external climate events such as droughts or floods. But later, of course, there was also critique against this kind of an approach, and there was Oliver Rubin who analyzed the famines in post-independence India in the 1960s and early 1970s. And he actually kind of said that, well, you cannot say that just because a country is democratic, it actually reduces the propensity to famines, because he also showed through his research that electoral democracy could sometimes complicate access to food relief, especially in chronic conditions. And there are others who have also said that this has not really helped, particularly in India in the past decades, in preventing severe undernutrition and deaths due to starvation. And for me, actually, this narrative, because you have different ways of approaching famine or vulnerability related to food security. And this is basically, I suppose, also how we approach vulnerability and perhaps why it is so important that we have to understand what are the systemic causes. And then coming to your second question about are there communities and people who identify as vulnerable groups? So this is mainly maybe, especially with India, it's kind of a unique situation there, because on the one hand, you have existing widening inequalities in social, cultural, and economic situations. Part of it is also inherently perpetuated and historically because of class, caste, and religion. This affects the social mobility of communities. It limits their access to a dignified life because perhaps they have limited opportunities to education and also basic services. And then in a way as to address this persisting inequalities, many labels were kind of put forward by successive governments. So you have labels such as below poverty line, BPL, scheduled caste or SC, scheduled tribes or SD. And these were actually labels for communities who are really poor and marginalized. And this was a way of kind of through reservations in education and workplaces, and also enabling them access to basic food necessities, they were trying to, in some ways, extend access to equitable conditions for these people. So on the one hand, I can imagine that for somebody outside India, these labels may not seem empowering. But on the other hand, it has to some extent enabled systemically oppressed sections of the society an opportunity for a better life. And this, again, depends on who you kind of ask this question to. There are some communities who wear this label quite consciously and with a lot of pride. But on the other hand, because many of these labels are also the result of historic prejudice, some people may also prefer to conceal it because of the fear of stigma and discrimination.
And it's such a fragile balance, almost kind of this need to kind of understand the groups that have been historically marginalized and the causes that have led to that, as well as almost kind of understanding how can we also foster people's empowerment and like what does that look like and how do we kind of manage the two and not just use labels as a way to categorize. And I think this question, we were kind of connecting this to a term in psychology that was coined by the psychologist Albert Bandura, and he explored the role of self-efficacy, which is a bit like self-belief. And he describes it in his work that this is where we believe that the locus of control is. So as an individual or a community who have high self-efficacy, they would believe that they're able to achieve something. And then it's almost like it's a bit like a self self-fulfilling prophecy, they would create the conditions to then achieve that outcome. So this is in opposition to an individual or a community with low self-efficacy who don't believe that they are able to influence the outcome of a situation. And I think there's an interesting sort of question to explore here, where I'm really curious whether you've seen any links here with determining vulnerability. So if people in a community identify as vulnerable, are they more or less likely to hold those responsible to account or to take preventative measures, or does it act a bit like a defeatist label?
Yeah, you bring forward a lot of thoughts related to this. So you're right, psychological research has definitely kind of prioritized this kind of evidence from empirical context that people who perceive themselves to be vulnerable to environmental risk and who perceive themselves to be victims of injustice, perhaps they also perceive themselves to be more at risk from environmental hazards of all types. But I would also imagine that then in that case, we have to kind of complement it with a sense of community. There is also a need for proactive participation in adaptation and governance mechanisms. And what really comes to mind then for me is that collective dimensions of self-efficacy can actually be helpful in certain situations. And here I would like to take you back to the example of Kerala, where the floods happened, for instance. So I had interviewed decision makers, representatives from governance, local NGOs, community leaders, all of them who had actually actively participated in both the floods in 2018 and 2019. And part of the reason how they were able to kind of return to normalcy, what they said was that community resourcefulness really helped play a big role, as well as decentralized governance, because there was people on all levels kind of coming together across sectors and bypassing bureaucracy, which usually doesn't happen. And that's part of the reason why they were able to deal with the floods, even though it was quite unexpected. And if I were to compare to maybe other similar contexts which are vulnerable, where civil society is not that organized, which does not have decentralized governance, they probably could not have done this in the way that it happened there. But at the same time, if you kind of look at it in terms of dealing with long-term challenges, community resourcefulness and decentralized governance might not be intrinsic factors. In fact, I think unless you accompany this idea of self-efficacy with structural organizational change and better decision-making frameworks, there might be limitations to it depending on the context. And part of the reason why I also say this is that, especially in developmental context where governments do tend to not follow through their duties, too much focus on self-efficacy could maybe even lead to an abdication of government and institutional responsibility.
So we just touched upon labels, right? And I was wondering, what are the impacts of these labels, like related to what we identify as vulnerable communities at different scales, but also like how does it maybe shape the way we deal with the margins?
Very interesting question, actually. I mean, I don't even know if this question has a very straightforward answer, because let's just maybe look at it from the smallest scale. So if you look at it from an individual perspective, vulnerability is often very personal. It is often tied to your perception of the world. It's tied to your decisions, your choices. And Brené Brown discusses this quite often in her work, through her TED Talks, her podcast, and her books. And I think mostly the discussion here pertains to, okay, to what extent can you be vulnerable at your workplace? How do you go about doing that? How do you reconcile with ideas of shame? How do you own your vulnerability? And I think these are great concepts, especially if you want to kind of look at self-growth. But I would also imagine that even this idea of looking at vulnerability at such a personal level, there is a certain aspect of privilege tied to it. There is a sort of luxury tied to it. And if you look at it from the standpoint of somebody who is on the other end of the spectrum, somebody who lives in chronic conditions, in fragile environments, who are deprived of access to basic services, who probably has to struggle on a daily basis, in their case, they don't have the luxury to out themselves as vulnerable. They are usually portrayed top down by experts or decision makers or humanitarian agencies as vulnerable. So in a way, for them, the luxury of choice is absent. And obviously, I'm kind of really referring to two very extreme examples. These are on two ends of the spectrum, two margins. And then, of course, if you also bring in notions of gender and race and class and intersectionality into it, vulnerability then begins to occupy a very wide spectrum. And they're on such different levels, I imagine that there is not even a good comparison there. And in some levels, I guess maybe here is where even the most eternal optimist in me becomes a pessimist, because I'm like, well, is there always going to be a world where there are haves and have-nots? But this is not to also say that we have to kind of favor one narrative for the other, that personal grief should not be cast aside. But they are very different. And I think we have to acknowledge that. Maybe this is where we also say, is it an East versus West narrative? Is it an individualistic versus a collective narrative? And I would like to leave it quite open here, because I'm also curious maybe if you have any thoughts on this.
I have some thoughts, because I think it links very well to our next topic. So the topic we wanted to also explore with you is the notion of vulnerability as a human condition. And so there's this interesting trend that we're observing, almost like two parallel bubbles that are evolving. So on one hand, vulnerability, it seems a bit as a positive for a positive thing for the elites. So, I mean, at my workplace, I'm encouraged to opening up and connect as humans rather than professionals. Vulnerability is something that's starting to be revalued somehow. While on the other hand, there seems to be a narrative of vulnerability as a negative when we talk about communities exposed to the effect of climate change. So on my side, I'm sitting with this question: who's really allowed to be vulnerable? And in which context? And who has to be resilient? And how might we integrate these two aspects, the positive and the negative?
Yes, indeed. And I think here maybe one useful way to understand this is, let's go back to the foundational aspects of the two contexts. Because on the one hand, you have mainstream hazard research traditions, which kind of say that, okay, the key to understanding vulnerability lies in the interactions between social dynamics within a socio-ecological system. And it's these dynamics that are important for resilience. So one convergence on vulnerability and resilience research actually comes from this consistent focus on socio-ecological systems. And in addition, there is also converging points of interest, because mainly we discuss these concepts in light of shocks and stresses that are experienced by the systems, the response of the system, its capacity for adaptation to action. And it's this context within we place it, and then resilience often has a positive connotation, because most of the definitions for resilience is it is the capacity to self-organize, it has the capacity for adaptation to emerging circumstances. And parallelly, vulnerability is then portrayed a bit negative, because vulnerability is then the degree to which a system is susceptible, and often it is unable to cope with adverse effects. And then in that case, very simplistically put, does it mean that if we increase resilience, can we reduce vulnerability? And if then, resilience of who and of what? Vulnerability of whom? And I think maybe this again depends on what lens you use to view vulnerability. Because on the one hand, it could be vulnerability as an outcome, or it could be contextual vulnerabilities. And I imagine that this is particularly very important in the context of climate change, where vulnerability is characterized as a system and as a function of exposure, sensitivity, and adaptive capacity. And if I again come back to the context of India, because of a combination of climate change, liberalization of trade, and current corporately influenced government policies, all of this are actually changing the context of small-scale farming and agricultural production. In a way, it probably also induces further vulnerability for these fragile communities of farmers. And you might have even followed this a bit in relation to the ongoing recent farming protest in India.
I think you put it so beautifully and so powerfully. And I think these different dimensions, you know, like you were kind of mentioning the positive and the negative, the East and West, the collective and individual, the centralized and self-organizing, And the different scales, really, the policy, the governance, looking at trade dynamics. And I think it's really, really interesting to kind of see how they kind of play out and what might integration look like and for whom as well. Like, I think these are really, really key questions to take forward. And we wanted to bring a bit of poetry into this as well. So the poet David White summarizes, and this speaks a bit to how do we integrate also vulnerability as a human condition. So he really beautifully says, vulnerability is not the weakness, a passing indisposition, or something we can arrange to do without. Vulnerability is not a choice. Vulnerability is the underlying, ever-present, and abiding undercurrent. The only choice we have is how we inhabit our vulnerability, how we become larger and more courageous and more compassionate through our intimacy with disappearance. Our choice is to inhabit vulnerability as generous citizens of loss, robustly and fully, or conversely, as misers and complainers, reluctant, fearful, always at the gates of existence, but never bravely and completely attempting to enter, never wanting to risk ourselves, never walking fully through the door. We're not poets, but I think what really resonated with us in this quote is that we're losing so much at the moment. We've lost so many lives among us during COVID. We're losing landscapes, we're losing ecosystems, we're losing livelihoods due to climate change. So I'm really curious about your thoughts on, you know, to quote David White, how might we become generous citizens of loss? That's such a beautiful phrase.
I don't know if I have a good answer to that. I mean, I think as humans, are we even able to be such generous citizens of loss? Are we actually is it possible for us to become so gracious? I would love to say yes, but I am not so sure myself. But maybe pandemics like COVID and all the persisting crisis and the fact that we are actually headed for something very severe and intense until we take action, maybe this will help us reflect on our actions a little bit. And maybe we might get there. I would like to be optimistic about it.
And I do think there's something in here, you know, like how might we mobilize this vulnerability through collective action so that we don't just use it as a passive label, but really how do we use it as a way to acknowledge that we need to live within our planetary limits?
Yeah, definitely.
Just maybe also we got to this collective conscious of our vulnerability, maybe. Somehow we can hope that it will help us to enforce collective action.
Yeah, that's also a very big question, because I think the idea is to be quite hopeful about the use of vulnerability. And I would maybe turn to human ecology explanations for this, because of course we have persistent crisis. It's a combination of climate change, pandemics, chronic stresses, etc. And maybe because now we try to think also about it like policymakers or practitioners, maybe we could try to see vulnerability in collusion with operational dimensions of resilience. And then maybe adaptive capacity could actually be a helpful way to look at it. And in addition, I think we have to see beauty in working together. So we have tried to collectively work towards harnessing community capacity and then maybe work towards doing things in a more participatory and inclusive way, where things are more socially just and intersectional. And through that, I guess maybe we could try to somehow, then it's not perceived anymore as a weakness, but it actually becomes this underlying concept where it actually helps us to understand, okay, which are the approaches that we can actually use to respond better? And I'd like to maybe also refer to Ostrom's thoughts on this, where she says about how generally the issue of this is that it's usually the vulnerable people and places that are often excluded from decision-making. They are the ones who do not have access to power or resources. So we also need to configure the way how we look at the world. We've got to have a plurality of the types of knowledge. We've got to have better governance systems that can manage risks. And maybe through that, there would be an attempt to promote resilience.
Completely. And I think, you know, to your reflections, I have the voice of Jenna from the last podcast in my mind. And I think there's a parallel here, you know, when we were talking about feminism last time, but I think there's a parallel here with, you know, how do we see invincibility and conquest and not admitting defeat, almost kind of as patriarchic ways of relating, versus how might we actually almost kind of claim vulnerability as a feminist way of relating? So almost kind of like bringing this shift in perspective around how do we kind of work together? How do we harmonize? How do we find collective ways to actually speak truth to power? And you know, take pride in vulnerability, but also really, really kind of call out the systemic root causes. So yeah, I think this is this link with Jenna's ideas on feminism, I think, is a really key sort of bridge in here as well.
I'm so glad you brought this up, actually. This is what actually got me thinking a lot about as well, because on the one hand, we all know that with any concept, gender notions are always there. They remain glaring, but they're understudied. And in this case also as well, because we know that when you look at social differentiation with respect to gender, class, culture, age, and other power structures, and then we also look at where people live, their physical and mental health, the compositions of their household, their literacy status. And often when we combine all of this together, we do find that it is the women who are more at risk because they have a greater burden of work. And especially if you have a situation where an unexpected event has happened, they are the ones who have to work harder to recover their homes and their livelihoods. And overall, because of that, they are more vulnerable. They experience similar levels of exposure as the men, but because they have limited access to productive resources, their conditions of housing are poorer, their participation in decision-making is lesser, and at the same time, domestic responsibilities are heavier. And this is something we have to really address. If we want to talk about systemic changes, we have to address this. And critical feminist political ecology has highlighted this quite a lot. And they often say that you've got to try to join the effects of gender, access to land, education, and credit, because these are very significantly determining the capacity of a community or an individual to adapt to climate change. And I guess that's what we have to try to do as well, especially for those of us who are resilience practitioners and researchers and policymakers, we have to proactively avoid gender-blind notions of vulnerability. Only then we can actually really adapt, is what I would say.
I think there's a parallel here with, you know, how do we see invincibility and conquest and not admitting defeat almost kind of as patriarchic ways of relating, versus how might we actually almost kind of claim vulnerability as a feminist way of relating? So almost kind of like bringing this shift in perspective around how do we kind of work together? How do we harmonize? How do we find collective ways to actually speak truth to power? And you know, take pride in vulnerability, but also really, really kind of call out the systemic root causes. So yeah, I think this is this link with Jenna's ideas on feminism, I think, is a really key sort of bridge in here as well.
I think we're gonna leave it there with your wise words, and we're all going to reflect how we can enhance and maximize our impact. Thank you so much for your participation, and we were very happy to have you.
Thank you. It was my pleasure too. Great to be here with both of you.
Thanks for listening to Urban Resilience Dialogues. We are Karina Angeloyu and Chiara Tomaselli.
Want to get in touch with us? Drop us a line at urbanresiliencedialogues@gmail.com, or you can tweet us
with the hashtag #URDialogues.
Chat to you soon.